Every culture, country, and religion have some form of origin of the earth story. A creation myth, legend, or doctrine, if you will. From the ancient Egyptians' Heliopolis creation myth, to the Chinese Taoist Penghu, to the Judeo-Christian Adam and Eve, everyone has some theory of how the world was created. Even if you believe it was simply just a great big bang. I personally grew up on the story of the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve's life in paradise. But there is another version of this tale that, while very similar, has a distinct and very interesting twist to it. In the Quran's origin story, before Allah creates Adam, he creates an entity called jinns, born from a smokeless flame of fire. They were neither bad nor good, but rather created to worship and follow Allah just like their human counterparts. But the jinns also had free will and could choose not to pursue their designed path. When the time came for Allah to create Adam, he built him from the earth. Adam was constituted with dirt and clay. When the time had come for Allah to breathe life into Adam, he called forth all the angels and jinns to witness the event. Allah asked the assembly to bow and prostrate before the newly minted Adam. However, one jinn, Iblis, who was deeply devoted and dedicated to Allah, was jealous of Adam, and he refused to bow before him. According to the Quran, Allah called to Iblis and asked, "O Iblis, what is with you that you are not with those who prostrate?" Defiantly, Iblis replied, "Never would I prostrate to a human who you created out of clay from an altered black mud." Allah was incensed and cursed Iblis. In return, Iblis promised to dedicate his life to leading humans astray. Allah gave him both the curse and power to live until the day of recompense, and only then would the curse be lifted. Iblis's first goal was to lead Adam to eat the forbidden fruit from the tree of knowledge. Yet, when his attempts failed, he went after Adam's female counterpart, Hawa, and the rest is really history. Humans cannot see jinns, but it does not mean they cannot feel their presence or effect. They're not ghosts because ghosts are the souls of dead people, and jinns are a creation all of their own. They're not all bad. Some choose a righteous route and follow Allah, dedicating their existence to good. But as we see with the story of Iblis, some are evil, committed to leading humans astray. Jinns can whisper horrible thoughts, temptations, and ideas into the minds of humans, create challenges and roadblocks in their lives, and even possess them. Just like humans, there are good and bad jinns. And the bad ones can be truly fortified in evil. Hey friends, it's Becca. For the past 3 years, the West London Witch team have been dedicated to bringing you the best supernatural stories at the highest studio quality. And by team, I mean me and my buddy Danny. We do this work totally for free because we love it. We're proud of our content and appreciate the wonderful interactions we get to have with storytellers and listeners just like yourself. If you're enjoying The West London Witch, maybe consider joining our Patreon. It's a way to further engage with us and show your support for two creatives. If you're in a position to spare enough each month for us to grab a cup of coffee in between edits or add to the piggy bank for a new microphone, we would love to see you in our Patreon community. But I know times are tough, so if you're not in a position to join Patreon right now, that's okay. We aren't going anywhere. Head on over to patreon.com/thewestlondonwitch. For as little as £1, $1, €1 a month, you can gain full access to our coven, a space where we share behind-the-scenes stories, dive deeper into each episode, answer your questions, and have special little treats to thank you for sharing your love and kindness with your favorite little witch. Hello and welcome to episode 60 of The West London Witch, a podcast where we share stories about those moments where we find ourselves very much not alone. Today's story is all about one man's journey through life, the paranormal, and the very present and sometimes personal demons we all encounter. You may recognize Mustafa Gadelari from the TV show Haunted Discoveries and A&E's Ghost Hunters. Mustafa is a paranormal investigator and author of Elements of a Haunting. He's seen a lot of scary things in his career. But today's story isn't one you'll see on TV. It's personal, vulnerable, intimate. And I feel very honored that Mustafa trusted me to share it with you all. I'm Rebecca Strazina, and this is The West London Witch, episode 60, Plagued by the Paranormal.
So when I was 18 years old, I decided to seriously start investigating the paranormal. But I started doing it through the scope of a very religious lens. I was the Muslim darling of my family. I was the one who memorized the most number of verses from the Quran. And I was the one who prayed five times a day. I was the one who fasted the entirety of the month of Ramadan. I was considered the holy man of the family, which is kind of a crazy thing for a lot of people who know me now to think of. Initially, I decided to start investigating the paranormal because I was having a really hard time reconciling myself with a lot of the phenomena and the activity that occurred in my childhood home.
Mustafa's family originally hailed from Albania, from a long line of honest, hardworking farmers. When Mustafa was four, his immigrant family moved from New Jersey to New York. This was a new and exciting stage in the family's lives, but it came with some unexpected challenges.
And like many people from that kind of background, they had developed their own certain type of mythology and superstitions. When we first started encountering paranormal activity in my home, that we moved into in New City, New York from New Jersey, we immediately thought that it was some kind of djinn, or as Albanians called them, djinda. It's like, we're like, it's a djinda. There's a djinda in the house. There's a djinn in the house. There's something gnarly happening here. The activity began from the first night from when we moved in. My older brother and I, we were in our room. Our room was huge. We shared a bedroom, and it was about the size of the apartment that we had grown up in Jersey, in Lodi, New Jersey, and we were just so ecstatic.
This new house was awesome, and the kids were ecstatic. They had a big backyard to explore, an exciting new school to learn and play at, and a beautiful new town to become acquainted with. The world was their oyster.
We felt like we were living the American dream. It's like, this is happening. We weren't all cramped into a tiny little apartment, and we had the big house. And my mom was happy. That was the most important thing to me. My mom was happy because I would like see her like Cinderella, you know, just working and taking care of my grandparents and doing all the things that, you know, a Muslim woman from an Eastern European traditional patriarchal background did. But on that first night, I remember it was about 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning, and my older brother and I were in our room, and we started hearing some noises in the house. And My older brother and I, we grew up on action movies. That was probably my religion. If I look back on it now, I'm Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jean-Claude Van Damme and, you know, Predator. And it was fine for my father to show us films of people getting, you know, drowned in toilets or lit on fire. But if there was like a boob or something on the screen, we'd get hit or something like that. But action movies were fine. That was our religion. So like any good action hero, the second we heard noises, we looked at each other. We're like, someone's breaking into our new house. We're going to murk this fool. Like we're going to stick it to them. And my older brother, he went into we had this huge walk-in closet and he grabbed a baseball bat from it. That was the best weapon available. And he was the older brother. He got access to the best one. I didn't really have anything, but there was a bicycle pump. And I grabbed the bicycle pump and I was thinking I was going to pull like a Big Trouble in Little China thing and like stick it in whatever bag I came and pump them up and blow them up. That was my thought process at the time.
Armed with their weapons, the brothers sneaked out of the bedroom on the upper floor to defend their new home. Mustafa's older brother was leading the way, baseball bat in hand, while little Mustafa followed brandishing his bicycle pump.
I can remember pretty much every detail of that moment. There was a huge chandelier that over the years, when my mom would clean it and we'd go and pick up pieces of it, and we broke it. It kind of got smaller and smaller. And you could see the, you know, that romantic blue glow of the moon. And it was just there. It was so magical. It was so nice. And then I could see it shimmering through the hallway. It's beautiful. And hear the noise, and it was coming from beneath us. And it was one of the kitchens in the home. It had two kitchens. That's what my mom was really excited about, because my grandmother could go and make all of her old non-Albanian kind of dishes. And my mom had her own kitchen space, so they didn't have to step on each other's toes. So it was in the second floor kitchen, and we heard all these noises. Bah, 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 bah. So my brother's walking down there, the baseball bat. And I'm following behind him with my pump, ready to explode someone. And the noise is getting louder and louder and louder. So we start to turn the corner to go into the kitchen, and we're waiting there. There's someone in there, and it sounded like someone's rifling through drawers or something, which is weird. There's nothing in the house. We had just moved in. Maybe there's a couple of, you know, boxes of pasta or whatever it is that we brought. And we jump out like we're going to get the drop on somebody, and there's no one there. But all of the drawers and the cabinets are opening and closing by themselves. Pop, 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 pop. So we've watched the movie Beetlejuice. We've watched all the horror films and stuff like that. And we looked at each other and we're like, this is awesome. Like, this house has a ghost in it. Or like, there's something here. We thought it was the coolest thing in the world. We thought we had a magic house.
At this point, Mustafa's parents had also awoken. His dad was upset, thinking the boys were playing around and making noise. So Mustafa's mom came down to the kitchen to see what all the commotion was about.
So I hear my mom trudging down the stairs, and she's coming. And she's like, what are you guys doing? What are you guys doing up? And she comes and she goes into the kitchen. She stops and she sees it too. Opening, closing, opening, and closing. Lasts for a few more seconds. She's there speechless. It stops. And she immediately launches into a prayer, saying every bit of Quran that she knows. She calls my great-grandfather, who was originally from Albania, and he came there to bless the house and do some kind of what I think is like a cleansing or whatever, but it didn't really stop the activity. It just kept going, and there was a lot of weird things that occurred in that house. My younger brother and sister would claim every night they'd see these things they called fire babies flying around them at night, and you'd always catch someone in the corner of your eye walking. My older brother had this friend that he talked to in the garage, which was an older man who he described as tying shoelaces but around his neck.
This was a challenging time for the family. A lot of hardship befell them, and living in such an active house certainly didn't help.
You know, my father was always trying to make the big money in one fell swoop, and attributed his inability to be as financially successful as he wanted to this djinn. You know, the house is cursed. We're living in a haunted house. It's, you know, it's the djinn. That's why I can't make money. my mom and dad's marriage is like, oh my God, our marriage is falling apart. Like, you know, we hate each other and we're always fighting. It's the gin. It's like, no, it's because you got an arranged marriage at 17 years old to somebody you don't know. That's why. So I kind of had a resentment for the paranormal activity that we all kind of thought we witnessed in the house. And I started to doubt that we even felt it in the first place or saw it in the first place, even though I remember it very vividly. And a lot of the things that occurred in that house very vividly. And I remember when it stopped, which is when my uncle and his family of seven, when they had fallen on hard times, and we had such a huge house. I mean, that bottom floor had its own kitchen, multiple rooms. He came to live with his wife and kids in our house, and my dad let him stay there for free.
Things were tough. Money was slim, hardships abounded, and tensions were high. But through it all, there was light. The family had each other, and that was something no unseen force could take away.
Years later, I wanted to know about the house. We had moved out when I was like 12. I was there from when I was like 4 till 11 or 12, right before my 12th birthday. We had lost the house. My father couldn't afford it anymore. The realtor was kind enough to let us squat in it for a few months. We didn't have any electricity or hot water, but we could pay the gas bill. So we would boil like water and then let it cool down and take our showers and stuff like that. I remember that. And but then my dad started working in construction and he launched a pretty successful business and we were able to get out of there and we moved back to New Jersey. So when I turned 18, I was like, this stuff all happened. I know it happened. I want to investigate it. So I did.
Once Mustafa turned 18 and had his own car, he headed back to New York to find out more about the history of his childhood home. Was it a djinn in the residence or perhaps a human ghost?
And the person who had passed away there, from the accounts I heard from neighbors, it was a predominantly Orthodox Jewish community. This man took his own life from what I heard from neighbors, but it was reported as he died of natural causes. He owned a very successful insurance company, a private insurance company, and he never married. He did get married, but he never had a family and he never had kids, from what I understand. And apparently he really wanted a family and he really wanted to have kids, but he never did. And that's what he intended to do. He intended to, I think from what I heard from neighbors and everything, is that he intended to get married to somebody, have their mom and dad live with him, which is why he had built a first floor with its own place. This is basically a two family house. And he just never did. And he hung himself, from what I heard from people, but his death was reported as a, natural causes.
If the original homeowner did die by suicide, it adds a whole nother level of scary to Mustafa's brother's interactions with the man in the garage, the one he described as tying shoelaces around his neck. This may have been Mustafa's first paranormal investigation, but it began a whole new chapter in his life. Because Mustafa was so devoted, so religious, and so dedicated to his beliefs, family and friends began to come to him when they felt like they too had unexplained activity in their homes.
I used that as an opportunity to investigate people's homes from a paranormal viewpoint, and I kind of used my religious know-how as like pageantry to help people with their issues. My idea was that a lot of times it wasn't really paranormal activity. It was just people who are too afraid to live the kind of life that's going to make them happy. I was very, very angry as a kid seeing the stupid choices my father would make time and time again that would put us in jeopardy, and just hated hearing bill collectors calling the house and seeing my mom upset and like crying all the time and blah, 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 and all that stuff. And it just used to get me so mad. And I was like, why are people such losers? Like, why can't people just make smart choices? So I would use that and I'd go to people's houses, go to my family members' houses, friends' houses, and be like, well, okay, like there's something here, but I think that this is going to help you. And I kind of use it as like a self-help thing. I'd be like, okay, like, you got to stop drinking for like 2 months. And this is what's empowering the spirits here. And this, you got to stop this. And most of the time that would work. somebody gets out of a job that they hate, they go and do a job that they like, cool. They stop drinking so much, or they stop doing drugs, or maybe they spend more time with their family members, or go on a vacation somewhere, or just get out of a bad relationship. Like, that usually helped.
Mustafa was helping to make a positive change in his family and within his community. His investigations were successful. Sometimes people knew the changes they needed to make in their lives and simply needed a third party to confirm that. But one case was definitely not like the others.
One of my cousins, she's a second cousin, she lived in a condo in Staten Island. I remember seeing her at a family gathering, and she had told me, she's like, I hadn't seen her for years. And she's like, hey, Taffy, how's it going? And she was all sheepish. She looked terrible. And just like very, very tired looking. Her hair was very thin. She was young. I mean, she looked like she was in her late 50s, but she was like 28. Like, you know, there's no reason anybody should have looked like that. So she's like, they tell me that, like, you know, you go to people's houses and you look at gene does. I think I have something in my house. And I was like, really? And she's like, yeah. Do you think you can come and check it out? And I said, okay. So I went to go to her house, and she was there with her husband at the time. And the guy was just a total loser. He was so rude. He was just like a miserable man. Like, you know what I mean? Just a real piece of work. I'm like, okay. Put that in my head. I'm like, all right, this is one bad problem. And I could tell there was tons of empty wine bottles and stuff in the thing. I'm like, okay, cool. She's an alcoholic. And then, you know, check her medicine cabinet. And, I saw she had these like Adderalls, but like, I knew she was, I know those weren't prescribed. She was buying them. I probably knew the guy she was buying them from because I could recognize that special kind of container. Used them in all times. So I'm like, all right, so she's basically doing baby cocaine, drinking a ton, hates her job working as a medical assistant, medical billing assistant, wherever she's at. And she's in a horrible relationship. Very, very, very cut and dry case. So I remember hanging out with her a couple weeks after that. You know, I did the whole thing. I blessed the house. I sat there and I was like, okay, there's this stuff going on. And I was like, you know, I'm like, listen, the number one thing that I've seen that's helped people is that love of something really, really transcends any kind of pain that you're going to be feeling in these kinds of situations. These things prey on you to be depressed and sad all the time. If you do more of things that you love, that's literally the only way that you can do it. Because prayer, doesn't matter how many prayers you go to or how many times you go to the masjid or whatever surahs you say, I'm like, those are not going to trump whatever it is that you're feeling, because you have to live it in action. I started giving examples of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, giving hadiths, all these different religious narratives about why you have to do belief in action and all that stuff. And to her credit, she did that.
Over the next 18 months, Mustafa's cousin drastically changed her life. She divorced her husband, found a new job that she loved and felt inspired by. She created a healthy relationship with alcohol and her social life. And the results were staggering. Her hair began to grow back. She looked vibrant and refreshed, and her whole world really had changed for the better.
But these experiences that she had continued. And those experiences were, she said that she would get these really, really, really horrifying, like brutally horrifying, ripped out of event horizon type nightmares. And she saw therapists, she saw psychologists, but she would always hear, she knew when she would get these nightmares because she would hear a voice that would whisper in her ear when she was at her house. And the reason why she drank so much was because she wouldn't hear the voice as much when she drank. And she would get these really vivid, horrifying dreams that she would wake up just completely disabled.
Her life was better, but the experiences in the house were not. This confounded Mustafa, so he agreed to stay in her home for some further in-depth investigation.
By that time, I had a remote job. I was writing for a cell phone blog. I told her, how about this? Go stay with your mom. I'll stay at your place for a few days. Because she was thinking about selling the place anyway. She had put it on the market and nobody was done. I'm like, I'll just stay here for a few days. And, you know, if somebody wants to come and see it, I'll show them around and all that stuff. She said, okay. So she went to go stay with her mom. She had most of her stuff moved out of there anyway. I went into the condo and was just doing my work. Everything's fine. You know, nothing wrong. It just seemed like a normal, lame kind of ticky-tacky Staten Island condominium. Like, you know, nothing to write home about.
Day one passed without incident. Mustafa believed his cousin, but this cookie-cutter condo had zero personality, good or bad.
And then during the second day I was there, I could swear in my left ear something go like, it's unintelligible, but it was just like, something straight out of a horror movie.
Mustafa was terrified to go to sleep that night. He couldn't deny or rationalize what he had heard. He spent a restless night tossing and turning, feeling as though he was being consumed alive by dread.
And then on the third morning, and I understand this sounds like it's literally like the classic horror films, rules of threes, like something Edgar Allan Poe would write. But it was on the third day, it's just every hour I just saw something out of the corner of my eye in the peripheral. And I'm literally sitting there writing and just turning my head all around, like there's something here. That voice again. Like just there. Freaking out. I wanted to get up and leave. I'm like, whatever, here, it can't be good. But I kind of was like, almost in a sickening way, was turned on by it, like in a very weird kind of self-destructive way. Like I didn't want to leave. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm like, wow, this, like, what if, like, as silly as it sounds, what if this thing kills me?
Mustafa was equal parts horrified and hooked. He decided to go into full investigator mode.
I had my audio recorder set up, went to bed, no problems, right to sleep. And I have a dream, and I'm in this apartment somewhere. I know it's not my home country or it's anywhere I've ever been. The air smells different. It's dry and it's like kind of almost sweet in a way. There's these very nice crown molding designs on the ceiling. There's brass and like gold fixtures. And I'm walking around. I look down at my arms and there's a child there. And I've never seen this kid. It's a baby, not an infant, but not a toddler. And this is my son. I don't have any kids at that time. I didn't have any kids, but I realized that this is my son and I've got no love for this kid, but I know it's my son. It's like I'm holding a jar of mayonnaise. I'm walking through this apartment, old world style, something in the early 1900s, maybe 1920s, but it's like a very, not a perversion of like a French aesthetic, but like an adapted French aesthetic. And I see a balcony, big area to stand in. There's clothing lines, there's sheets hanging from it, swaying in the wind. And I look out into the city and I'm on the top floor of a building and it's somewhere in the Middle East. And then I walk out through the sheets, can feel it like on my face and everything. And I'm walking through, baby starts like, you know, making some noises and I'm like holding it, petting its stomach. And then I can go and I can see cars I've never seen before, models I've never seen before, but they look like real cars. And I could see the ocean in the distance. And then without thinking, without a voice or a word or an emotion, I just take the baby and I throw it off the balcony.
Mustafa awoke to the sound of his own screaming. He was terrified and extremely upset.
F this place, F this house. I gotta get the F out of here. I'm angry, literally screaming at invisible monsters, just angry. Like I wanted to kill someone for even putting that in my head. Very, very angry. And because of the way I held resentment against my dad for his failures to like make sure we were financially secure and putting us in that bad position, I never, ever wanted to have kids. Like ever, ever, ever. I never wanted to do it. I was like, I'm never going to do it. Never going to have a kid. Never going to put them through that. I'll never do it.
Many years later, Mustafa met the love of his life, Miriam. They had a gorgeous start to their relationship, and a marriage soon followed.
She gets pregnant just a few months after we get married. And I was very, very just taken aback and just like, what the hell? We had talked about having kids, and I definitely knew she could be an amazing mom, and she kind of made me feel okay with the idea of having one, but I was like, this is just way too soon. She ended up giving birth to our son, Zach, in September of 2015. He's 8 now. So after he got a little older and, you know, she's feeling great, he's healthy, he's beautiful, such a good kid. He was about 9 and a half, 10 months old. My wife, she was like, I really want to go visit my family. I haven't seen them in a while, and I want you to visit them too.
Miriam moved to the U.S. when she was 5. Her family was originally from Alexandria, Egypt. She was excited to take her husband and new baby back to visit her extended family.
Got all the preparations for that. It was crazy. It was like Prince Ali arriving with like all his like gifts and stuff for everybody. We had luggages filled with gifts, and I met her family members, and they're all so cool. And they're like old world families from Egypt, from both sides. Like they're very, very, very well respected, hoity-toity and all that stuff. And but they're great people. They're very, very, very nice. And I had so much fun over there with them. I think it was like the first week we were there. She's like, we're going to go visit my teta, which is her grandmother on her dad's side of the family. She's like, we're going to go visit my teta. You got to love her place. Like she lives in this really awesome spot in Alexandria. So we end up going to this beautiful old school building in Alexandria. And I don't know if you know about the history of Egypt, but it was occupied by the French at the turn of the century. And it was like, we're talking their movies, incredible. Their architecture, the art, everything that came out of there at that time was just magnificent.
Excited to meet Miriam's grandmother and to see her place, the family headed to the top floor of a beautifully ornate building in the middle of the city.
This, saying hi to all her family members and everything, I just feel a little uneasy like while I'm doing it. And I'm just kind of talking to everybody, and it's just such a beautiful apartment, and it doesn't even need an air conditioner because when you open the windows, it's like the breeze is just kind of coming in. Her cousin's like, hey, you want to come out on the porch with me? I want to have a cigarette. He's like, well, I don't really smoke. So I'm like, yeah, I'll come out with you. So I go and I'm walking through the kitchen. Then I go out into the balcony and I walk through a sheet. I'm like, I've seen this balcony before. And I look at the skyline and it's the same skyline from the dream. Go and I start looking around the house back inside, and it's the same crown molding, it's the same fixtures. My legs are getting kind of like light, even just talking about this. I can't feel my feet right now, actually, as I'm telling this. And I see the vases, all the fixtures, everything directly from the dream. I smell the air. I couldn't smell it before because they were cooking up a storm, but I smelled the air and it was that same god damn smell. And Miriam's uncle's, one of her uncles is holding my son. And he's like, we're going to do the family tradition now. I said, what's the family tradition? And then Miriam says, well, they do this thing. They hold the baby over the balcony. And I can't say anything. Like, I don't feel like it's like my place. And I'm just completely speechless. And I'm like, oh, I just got to go to the bathroom. You guys go do it. And they went and they did it. And it was fine. Like, they go and they hold the baby like Simba over the balcony thing. And they do that. But I never told her that. And I really, really, really had no idea what that dream meant up until probably a couple of weeks ago. It was something that was futuristic and something personally that I struggle with. And it was very mocking and mean. And it is a thing that I will personally have to deal with for the rest of my life, not in a tragic, woe is me kind of way. But as scary as that incident was in the condo and then on that balcony, I'm almost grateful for it in the sense that it really, really helps to kind of keep at the forefront of my mind what I need to persevere as a person, I think, to be happy.
It's hard to know what happened in this story. Was it a djinn, a ghost, or a malevolent being? We don't know. Mustafa isn't even sure he believes in those entities. Yet, all the same, it did occur.
I mean, I don't know how I was able to essentially look into the future with that dream. I don't know what that's about. I don't know. I have no idea. I talked to my younger brother about it. You know, we used to go on a lot of investigations together, and he doesn't really do it that much anymore. But he studies djinn a lot, and he studies old world pre-Islamic kind of entities. And he's convinced it's some kind of like ancient entity or ancient evil that just so happened to be in that area for whatever reason. And it was preying on whatever type of energy that was there, and it just decided to stay there.
Regardless of whatever set these horrifying events into motion, there is a positive takeaway from this story.
In a weird way, are you grateful for this experience?
100% grateful for that experience. I think every single person has their own weakness that they have as an individual. And it's from the confrontation of that weakness that we have as individuals that can really, really be the limitless source of our own personal ability to create things and literally, quite literally, create our own happiness. When you're able to punch that proverbial bully in the face and really have fun almost with your personal demons, you know they're there. It sucks having to deal with your own personal BS all of the time, but not settling for it. That can be a weakness for you if you settle for it or if you ignore it. But if you stand up to it, confront it, use it in a creative way, and using that as energy to do whatever it is that you need to do, that's what's going to, I believe, make you happy. And this for me is a very, very, very specific thing that I believe, as crazy as it sounds, was prognosticated by whatever the hell it was inside of that building. And I look at it and it's like, ooh, okay, this is a very real thing I'm afraid of. This is a very real thing that I do not like about myself, but I know that that's what I have to persevere. So what am I going to do? Am I going to ignore it, or am I going to use that to live the best life that I can?
I appreciate Mustafa's positive outlook on these events. To be able to look at one's past as an opportunity to better your future takes a lot. Mustafa now uses this experience to help him enjoy and prosper in the present and set forward a happy life for his future. Thank you, Mustafa, for your openness, candor, and vulnerability. If you'd like to hear more of my chat with Mustafa, head on over to the West London Witch Patreon account and check out more of Mustafa's work on the Haunted Discoveries TV show and A&E's Ghost Hunters. Do you have a spooky story you'd like to share? I'd love to hear it. Drop me an email at thewestlondonwitch@gmail.com. Or find us on Instagram and Facebook at The West London Witch. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. And come and follow us for additional content on Instagram and Facebook. Until next time, merry meet, merry part, and merry meet again. The West London Witch is created by me, Rebecca Strazina. Our sound designer and production magician is the incredible Danny Cross. Our theme music was bespokely written and performed by the wickedly talented Kyle Hall. Our cover art is the beautiful collaboration between Lizzie Wilson and Jake Bowser. Special thanks to Miss Sinead Bowers, our quality control and biggest cheerleader. And thank you to you, all of our listeners all over the world. These are your stories. Thank you for sharing them with us.